You're listening to The Truth Podcast from PursueGod.org.
Today, we're in part number four of our study on Islam. You can find the full resources at PursueGod.org. And we're going to talk today about something called Sharia law. And for probably most of you, when I say that phrase, you're thinking about physical punishment. You're thinking about the Taliban in Afghanistan, oppression, political protests in the streets. And you're probably wondering, when is this coming to America? In the West, in our worldview, we have this hard line drawn in the sand between church and state. We believe that faith is a private thing you do in your heart on Sunday, and law is a public thing that the government does Monday through Saturday. But in many parts of the world, in Islam, that line just simply doesn't exist. In fact, it has never existed. To a Muslim, trying to separate God's law from public life is like trying to separate wet from water. So today we're going to unpack Sharia law. We're going to look at where it comes from, how it works in the daily life of a Muslim, and then ultimately we're going to talk about how it contrasts with the Christian concept of living under grace. In Arabic, the word Sharia literally translates to the clear, well-trodden path to water, or just more simply, the path to the waterhole. I want you to put yourself in the shoes or the sandals of an ancient Bedouin living in the arid, brutal deserts of the Arabian Peninsula, and think about it. For that guy, water is not a luxury. It really is like life and death to him. So if you're wandering in the desert, you lose your path to the oasis, you don't get thirsty, you're probably going to die out there. So the path to the waterhole is your only hope of survival. It brings life. It brings salvation from the harshness of the desert. So when Islamic scholars started using the word Sharia to describe God's legal and moral code, they were trying to paint a picture. It was using these words that a desert dweller would have totally understood. They were saying the world is harsh, it's confusing and chaotic. It's easy to get lost out there. It's easy to get cut off from the source of life. But God, in his mercy, he hasn't left us to wander and die. He's given us a clear, well-trodden path. If you stay on this path to the waterhole, you'll find life. And this is why so many devout Muslims in the world actually love Sharia. They view it as the roadmap to surviving in the world that's dangerous and deceptive and can lead to death. And so you're asking, well then, what exactly is on this path? What are the rules for Sharia according to Muslims? And the answer isn't as clear-cut as most Westerners would expect. There's not some giant leather-bound book sitting on a desk somewhere in Saudi Arabia, like the US Constitution, telling Muslims all over the world how to live. Because Sharia isn't a single document. It's a vast, complex, and really sometimes fluid system. And it's derived from four primary sources. The first source, of course, is the Quran. This is the baseline. We've talked about this in earlier episodes, that Muslims believe the Quran is the literal dictated word of Allah, of God. It has high moral authority. But the problem is the Quran is a lot shorter than the Christian Bible. In fact, the Bible has about 10 times as many words as the Quran. And on top of that, in the Quran, only about 10% of it deals with specific laws. So it gives general commands like pray or don't steal, but it doesn't give a lot of specifics on how to do those things in every situation. So the Quran is just the first source. It's just the baseline when it comes to Sharia law. The second source is the Sunnah or the Hadith. So the Quran is like the theory behind how to live, and the Sunnah is the practice. The Sunnah is the example of Muhammad the Prophet. So because Muslims view Muhammad as the perfect human being, even more perfect than Jesus, everything he did is considered the model for humanity. So his sayings and his habits and his rulings, all of these things were written down by his companions in thousands of stories called the Hadith. So if a Muslim wants to know exactly how to pray or how to wash their hands or how to conduct a business deal, they look to see how Muhammad did it in the Hadith. That's the second source for Sharia law. But what happens when a modern issue comes up and it isn't in the Quran or the Hadith? What does Sharia say about like cryptocurrency or organ donation or using the internet? This is where the third and fourth sources come in. It's the consensus of the scholars along with analogical reasoning. So basically, Islamic scholars are called the ulama, look at the Quran and the Hadith, and they draw analogies to modern problems so that they could reach a consensus around how to apply it in the Muslim world today. And the thing is, you've got different scholars in different parts of the world. So when you see Sharia applied really strictly, say in Afghanistan, but then you look at Jordan and you think that Sharia law is pretty moderate there, it's not because they have different Qurans, it's because they have different scholars. And the human interpretation varies based on the culture and the scholars in charge. And so those are the four sources for establishing Sharia law in Islamic countries today. You have the Quran, the Hadith, and the consensus of scholars with their analogical reasoning. But the real question is, how does it actually play out in daily life? In the Western Christian tradition, we are really comfortable with categories, right? We have our spiritual life, read your Bible, go to church, pray, and then we have our secular life, go buy a car, go to the gym, sign a contract, go to work. But in Sharia, that distinction doesn't even exist. Everything is spiritual. Everything is governed by Allah. And so Sharia is broadly divided into two main categories. The first is what we would traditionally think of as religion, acts of worship. This governs the five pillars that we talked about in the last episode. So Sharia dictates when you pray, what direction you face, how you fast during Ramadan, how you give to charity. All of that is the first part of Sharia law. It's the religious part, the acts of worship for a Muslim. The second part is where Sharia becomes a comprehensive societal blueprint. This is the part of the law that deals with human relations. It covers family law like marriage and divorce and custody and inheritance. It covers business. It covers criminal justice. And it even covers dietary laws like what is halal, what is permitted, and what is haram, what is forbidden. That's why you'll never see a good Muslim eating pork or drinking alcohol. Think of it this way. Sharia doesn't just want to tell you how to get to heaven. It actually wants to tell you which foot you should use to step into the bathroom. And you think I'm joking, but there's actually a hadith tradition about stepping into a bathroom with your left foot first. Now, to the Western mind, this sounds crazy, but to a devout Muslim, there's a lot of security in this. You never have to guess what God wants you to do. The path to the waterhole is meticulously mapped out. In fact, to help people navigate this, Sharia scholars typically categorize every human action into one of five buckets. Number one, you have the obligatory stuff. You must do this. And if you don't do it, you're sinning, like daily prayer. Number two, you have the recommended stuff. Like, God likes it when you do this, but you won't be punished if you don't. Number three, you have the neutral stuff, the stuff that God doesn't care either way about. Number four, you have the stuff that is discouraged, the stuff that God doesn't like, the stuff you should avoid, but it isn't strictly illegal. And number five, you have the forbidden stuff, the stuff that you must not do, like murder or drinking alcohol. So for a Muslim, Sharia is an absolute system that gives you moral clarity. But all of that was just the most gracious technical explanation of Sharia law. I just made it sound like Sharia law is a beautiful spiritual discipline for the whole society. But what about all those brutal punishments? When Sharia law moves from being a personal spiritual discipline, which is how most Muslims in America practice it today because we're not an Islamic culture. So when it moves from that to being the enforced law of a theocracy, that's when we see the problems. That's when we see human rights issues. In countries like Iran or Saudi Arabia, where Sharia is heavily intertwined with the state, the law is used to enforce religious conformity through state violence. And because Sharia categorizes humanity differently based on religion and gender, it inherently creates a tiered society. In fact, under classical Sharia, non-Muslims living in an Islamic state don't have the same legal rights and protections as a Muslim does. This is the dark side of a system that tries to force outward compliance through legal enforcement. You can force a woman to wear a head covering by threatening her with jail time. You can force a guy to stop drinking alcohol by threatening him with lashes. So the reality over the centuries is that state-enforced Sharia creates a society of external order, yes, but it breeds internal resentment and fear and even hypocrisy. You might submit to the law because you're terrified of the religious police, but that doesn't mean your heart is submitted to God, which is what Islam is supposed to be about. And this is where the gospel of Jesus offers a completely different paradigm. Paul says it like this in Romans chapter 6. Sin is no longer your master, for you are no longer living under the requirements of the law. Instead, you live under the freedom of God's grace. Think about how Muslims deal with sin in the law-based system of Sharia. They manage it through requirements. They build this massive fence of rules around sin to keep people away from it. But right there in the Bible, Paul says something revolutionary. He says, the requirements of the law can't actually free you from the mastery of sin. In other words, Sharia is not actually the pathway to the waterhole. You can put a tiger in a cage and convince yourself that the system is working, right? From the outside in, that tiger is not going to hurt you. But the truth of the matter is the tiger hasn't changed at all, right? As soon as you remove the boundaries, you'll see that tiger's real nature come through. The cage didn't actually change anything. And this is the reality of Sharia law. You can set up those boundaries all you want, and you can enforce those boundaries with your government. But those boundaries, that law, doesn't have the power to change a person's heart. The message of Christianity is different than the message of Islam. Jesus didn't just build a better cage for us. The good news of the Bible is that Jesus actually deals with the problem inside of us. He changes our hearts when we put our faith in him. Now, this doesn't mean that we'll be perfect. This doesn't result in a bunch of sinless people. But it allows us to begin to obey him from the inside out rather than from the outside in. An inside out faith, which is what Christianity offers, is really the only pathway to true freedom. Jesus said, I have come to give you a rich and satisfying life. The way of Jesus, not the way of Muhammad, is really the only pathway to freedom. So the next time you hear the word Sharia on the news, just let it be a reminder to pray for the millions of people who are exhausted from trying to climb a ladder of rules. They're trying to keep this dangerous old person caged up. And when you talk to your Muslim friends, don't get bogged down in arguing about politics or the laws of foreign countries or Sharia law. Just talk to them about the exhaustion of the cage. Talk to them about the freedom of a changed heart, which can only come through Jesus, who's more than a prophet, He is the Son of God.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share this episode with a friend. Find more resources to talk about these topics with your small group, family, or mentor on pursuegod.org.